this week's Solar Power: flawed technology or policy failure?
One of the things that we'll be looking at is the impact of renewable energy on power prices, because not only is the carbon tax adding about 9% to everyone's power bills, renewable energy targets are also significantly driving up power prices right now.
In a recent review of Australia's renewable energy target recommended the federal government wind back or scrap the pledge to have a 20% of Australia's energy produced by renewable sources by 2020.
The Prime Minister promised the Australian people prior to the last election that Australia would retain its renewable energy targets. Now, like many other promises, he seeks to break this one.
Australia's Renewable Energy Target, or RET, was initially established by the Howard government in 1997 and expanded by the Labor government. Under the current targets, we're aiming to get 41,000 gigawatt hours of electricity from renewable energy by 2020. That was thought to be about 20%, but we now know it's going to be about 27% of expected electricity generation. Before the last election, both sides of politics pledged to retain the RET, but now the government task force has recommended winding back these targets. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we focus on one aspect of renewable energy, solar power, and the history of solar research and manufacturing in Australia. It might surprise you to learn that Australia was for many years a world leader in solar research and manufacturing. Gary Baverstock is a solar architect and former adjunct professor of energy studies at Murdoch University.
Well, after the Second World War, some of the old diggers had experience with engineering, and they were very practical in those days, came back. And the focus after the war was on population growth, you know, making a better world, what sort of energy we're going to use. And so these guys got in and started inventing solar water heaters and manufacturing prototypes, setting up factories, getting out and selling them. And Australia was really a world leader from the 1950s onwards.
And it's interesting because the CSIRO played a really important part in that, didn't they?
Yeah, there were some real giants there on the world scene. Roger Morse was the head of the CSIRO, and he specialised in research for solar water heaters.
For almost three decades, Australia was the world leader in the research and manufacture of solar hot water systems. Philip Jennings is Professor of Physics at Murdoch University.
Yes, there's no doubt that Australia was the world leader. They took up the ideas from a number of American inventors who didn't have government support, and the CSIRO put considerable effort into designing the rooftop solar hot water system and developing efficient design. And some of the CSIRO designs are still used by some of the commercial manufacturers today.
In the 60s, I remember Ron Brown, who started SolarAy in Perth, had a $3 million turnover, employed 30 people and exported to the Middle East in the 60s. In Perth, there was about 30% of the houses had solar water heaters on their roofs. So it just showed how effective they were, not only in making them and making them work, but to actually sell and get it out in the marketplace. Up to 1983, Solar Heart were the second biggest manufacturer in the world. But now, China manufactures, sells and installs 20 times the rest of the world put together. And in the last 10 years, Australia has become insignificant.
According to Robin Batterham, chief scientist at Rio Tinto and former chief scientist to the Howard government, solar hot water was never really economically viable.
Alternative energy has always been on the agenda in Australia, and it's always been about availability and economics. I mean, if you really wind the clock back, we're totally used to the fact that people used to heat their houses with wood. I can remember as a kid having to chop the blessed stuff. And equally, when you toured through the countryside or visited your uncle's farm or something, the water wasn't pumped up by electricity, it was pumped up by a windmill. And this is the classic of alternative energy, or renewable energy for that matter, being about availability and economics. So in those earlier circumstances, that's what was available, that's what we used, because it was economic to use it. Now, wind the clock forward to Roger Morse and CSIRO and the development of these blackened surfaces that allowed solar panels to be built. And you'd have to say it was great science, it was good application, but it was only just on the edge of being economic. And that's why it didn't take off like a rocket.
I think Australia's interest in solar hot water began at a time when it was recognised that energy was expensive and that we had an abundance of solar radiation, and it was a logical industry for us to be involved with, and we developed a thriving domestic industry. However, in the 70s, largely in response to the first oil crisis, a lot of new oil and gas discoveries were made off the Australian coastline that led to a reduction in the price of fossil fuels and competition between the solar hot water system industry and the gas and electric hot water system industries, which led to a lack of government support in that area, attempting to create what they'd call a level playing field. And solar has a bit of a disadvantage in having large upfront costs, even though the running costs are smaller. So the absence of any sort of financing packages made it less attractive to people who were stretched to the limit in creating a new home or buying a new home and couldn't afford an extra $3,000 to put a solar hot water system on the roof, even though it would save them considerably in the long run. And so they tended to go for the cheaper instantaneous gas or electric hot water systems. And so the market collapsed from about, I'd say about one new home in every four in Perth, for example, had a solar hot water system in the 1970s, to by the mid-80s, when cheap gas and hot water systems were around, to about one home in every 20, which is about what it is today.
In the US, the oil shocks of the 1970s sparked an interest in solar research. In Australia, however, the impetus came from a different direction. Martin Green from the Photovoltaic Centre of Excellence at the University of New South Wales is a world leader in the area of solar research.
Yeah, the interest started taking off mainly in the US in the early 70s as a result of the oil embargoes of that time. In Australia, the interest grew from a different direction, and that was because there was a practical application in telecommunications. So the old Telecom Australia was very early on realised the potential of photovoltaics in supplying some of its outback systems. So it was actually a pioneer in the practical use of the technology. I guess it was either 73 or 1974 when Telecom Australia started its program, I guess, experimenting with the solar panels that were then available, and none of them turned out to be reliable enough for what they wanted. So they actually provided manufacturers with feedback on how they could improve their panels to make them more suitable for what they needed, and helped promote the development of the industry by providing this experienced environmental testing of the panels. As a result of that, Telecom started using the panels in their outback systems from 1978, and ever since then it's been the main way of supplying power for their telecommunication equipment that's located in remote areas.
In the 70s and the 80s, stretching into the early 90s, we had a very productive period in Australian renewable energy research. It was at a time really when the Europeans weren't very interested. The United States had moved away from working in that field, apart from in the private sector. The government wasn't supporting it very much, but Australia was carrying on the R&D, and we were recognised internationally as leaders in the field. People from all around the world came here. I well remember we had a Solar World Congress in Perth in 1983, and we had something like 1,500 people from all around the world came to hear what was going on here. That wouldn't happen these days. And that work continued up until basically the mid-90s, when there was a change of government in Canberra and the coal industry became much more influential. One of the first things that the Howard government did was to abolish the Energy Research and Development Corporation.
The head of Sydney University's School of Physics, Professor Richard Collins, today appealed to the government to reverse a key decision it made in May this year. That was when it decided to wind up the Energy Research and Development Corporation.
There is nowhere now in Australia to go for a central coordinated approach to these energy-related research projects. We stand to lose our world leadership in the field. We stand to lose substantial income that might come from licensing this type of technology elsewhere.
Yes, I think the abolition of ERDAC in the 1990s had a big impact, because that was a source of dedicated funding for academic researchers that were working on newer energy forms. So that did have quite a large impact. And it was badly timed in that Chernobyl and so on, and growing awareness of greenhouse gas issues, had revitalised research programs in Europe in particular. And just at the same time, Australia was sort of out of phase and that we were chopping ours back.
The previous Keating government had set up a cooperative research centre for renewable energy that was called ACRE, that had a 7-year life. That had just gone through prior to the 96 election when the Howard government was elected. They allowed that to continue, but they didn't allow it to have a second term, and they closed that in 2004.
The person chosen to head the Cooperative Research Centre for Renewable Energy was mechanical engineer Martin Thomas.
Having established the CRC at Murdoch University, my very first activity was to work towards what I felt was essential, which was an Australian cooperative research centre embodying all of Australia's best. And to that end, I developed the name ACRE, Australian Cooperative Research Centre for Renewable Energy. And my vision was certainly to have a national centre paralleling, to some extent, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL, of the United States, highly supported by the US Department of Energy. Now, that model never really came about. It had a degree of support and a degree of opposition, I have to say. And without going into detail, I think to some extent that may have lain behind its failure to get renewal after the first 7 years, which is the way CRCs operate. But the loss of ACRE was a great tragedy to the industry.
In June 2004, the Howard government unveiled its Energy White Paper, a national strategy to deliver energy security and sustainability while maintaining economic prosperity.
Today we turn our attention to the long-awaited energy statement released by the Prime Minister. There's $500 million in incentives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, most notably by investing in research into pumping carbon dioxide underground.
Remember the row back in June when the federal government released its energy white paper and the renewable energy industry saw it as a huge letdown? Well, now the ABC's investigative unit has obtained leaked meeting minutes, emails and memos, which suggest that behind the scenes, the fossil fuels industry had a huge say in what went into that white paper.
There's an interesting thing about in moving from invention and discovery of the science at the bench level up into it being in widespread use. And that's tied up with the fact that there's an economic learning curve. We all know that when the first time you get something through to a prototype or the initial production stage, it costs a much, much higher than later on, a few years later when it's mass produced, everybody has them, people are used to installing them and using them and so on. So to me, the real question is not so much is the money available, it's have we got the incentives right to take things through from this early stage where it's terribly costly through to common usage? That to me is the challenge. And you're quite right. If there's immediate benefit, for example, a major mining development, that question doesn't arise because you can see the immediate benefit. But if, for example, it's a new breed of smart science in a solar thermal application, such as some of the work at ANU, then you look at it and say, yeah, but why should we pay as a user twice as much for our electricity as what we can get by burning natural gas or coal or whatever? That's a real challenge, and it's one of large-scale economics.
After 2004, really after 1998, the amount of funding available for renewable energy research from government sources declined very rapidly and virtually dried up altogether by the early part of this decade. And that's forced many of the researchers offshore, forced a lot of the companies out of business also, because a lot of the companies were doing R&D with funding from EIDC or from the Cooperative Research Centre for Renewable Energy. Once they lost that source of funding for their R&D, they lost their competitive edge. I'm aware of at least four medium-sized enterprises in Western Australia that were doing very well in the renewable energy business, but once the funding was cut off, they've basically gone out of business or have sold off their whole operation and moved it overseas. And this has happened all across the country. There are still some shining lights in the business, but many of the companies and many of the research groups have folded since the funding was cut off.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, we're taking a look at the history of solar energy in Australia. The countries around the world that have embraced solar energy with a vengeance are Japan, Germany, China, and some states in the US like California. And much of the technology they're using was developed here in Australia by researchers like Martin Green from the University of New South Wales and David Mills, formerly of Sydney University.
If any Australians haven't heard of Martin Green and David Mills, about time they did. Martin Green is treated like an absolute celebrity for being the professor who helped China get off to a flying start when it comes to renewable energy. David Mills has developed solar thermal plants, taking his evacuated tube collectors and many dish-type collectors that concentrate heat, produce steam, run turbines. And he's developing technology in Europe, Spain, Portugal, China. Again, a world figure. Had to go offshore to start applying his knowledge, his expertise, and his commitment. They could have been doing this in Australia 20 years ago if they had enough support. We're getting the kudos, well, they are personally, but Australia as a country hasn't benefited at all economically from their genius.
Most of the technology that's been made under license in the past, as I said, have been made by BP, but they chose to set up a new manufacturing facility in Europe using that technology. So even though the technology was developed here locally and BP tested it out in their production facilities here in Australia, when the final manufacturing plant was commissioned, it was done so in Europe because they had expansion plans there, whereas the Australian market was not growing as rapidly at the time.
So why is that? Because you're not the only major player in the solar world here in Australia. We've got a number of the really significant research people here, and yet most of the technology seems to be going offshore. Why doesn't it stay here?
I think to be successful with the technology these days, it has to be, you have to have an international focus rather than just the local focus. The local market is not large enough to support large-scale manufacturing of products such as photovoltaic panels. So you need to be looking at having a large share of the world market rather than just focusing on the Australian market. And with the programs that are in place in Europe, you know, that's the spot to be at the moment. So if your manufacturing facility is there, it's going to be easier to get the sales and so on, as well as many of the subsidies that are being awarded to promote the development of industry there.
One of the reasons the Howard government gave for supporting clean coal research over alternative technologies like wind and solar was because they didn't believe alternative energy could supply baseload power.
I have a completely open mind about various energy sources, but I do know that, and this is not just my view, it's the view of Australia's chief scientist, as of now, with all the available science, the only feasible ways of generating baseload power are either fossil fuels or, you know, variations thereof, or nuclear power. Now, that's not John Howard's view. That's the view of Australia's chief scientist.
Tonight, we bring you a story that promises to strengthen the claims by supporters of solar power that with proper backing, it can become a viable alternative to coal-fired power. With news from the United States that two of America's biggest power utilities have unveiled plans for a multi-billion dollar expansion of solar power supply. The company at the heart of their strategy is the one started by Australian solar expert David Mills, the former Sydney University professor. What makes the announcement more significant is that the utilities are confidently predicting that their solar power will soon be providing baseload electricity, that is, day and night, at prices competitive with coal.
economic settings and policy settings in Australia have been very disturbing, very difficult for the industry to work with. Compare the policies of governments like Germany and China and Japan and more recently even the United States. They're providing some security, some predictability about the future for industry, and this is what industry needs in order to make the massive investments it required. Australia, in comparison, keeps on changing its policies every 6 to 12 months, and a lot of the industry people have moved overseas because they can't work in that sort of environment.
And what technological advances have been made in that time? Because solar technology has really gone ahead in leaps and bounds.
Yes, it's been market demand has led to economies of scale. It was started by the Germans with their feed-in tariff, which was introduced about 10 years ago, and that led to a large increase in demand for solar products. Germany and the rest of Europe continued with this policy, and Europe was the main market for solar products, and the economies of scale produced by the rapid growth in the market, as much as 50% per annum, led to prices coming down at roughly the same rate as the market was growing because the larger plants could produce cheaper solar cells. But the Chinese noticed this and began investing quite heavily in renewable energy around 2010. And for the last 3 or 4 years, China's been on a rapid growth curve. China's now the world's largest market for solar cells and also the world's largest producer. And they take advantage of their cheap labour costs and the economies of scale that they've created. And Taiwan and Japan are also benefiting to some extent because they're also getting into this business. Now, not only have they improved the manufacturing technology, they've also made some technological improvements like making the cells a bit thinner, for example, which has brought down the costs. And then the United States has come into the picture through their thin film or second generation technology, and they've produced the cadmium telluride solar cell, which is now probably the cheapest one on the market and has captured quite a large proportion of the market. So there have been new technological advances in the thin film technology as well as economies of scale in the conventional crystalline technology.
Australia's one consistent energy policy has been the Renewable Energy Target, or RET. The original RET was established by John Howard in 1997 following the Kyoto Climate Conference.
Now, this is a major cost-saving and regulatory breakthrough.
Industry groups have welcomed the scheme, saying it creates much more certainty for the sector, which will encourage investment.
The Renewable Energy Target was a greenhouse abatement measure that was introduced originally by the Howard government back in the 90s to ensure that Australia produced a certain proportion of its electricity from renewable energy. And it was set originally at about 5% and was increased by the Rudd government to 20%.
Last month, Australia took a significant step towards a low pollution future, with the government's renewable energy target legislation passing the Parliament. Our renewable energy target will ensure 20% of Australia's electricity will come from renewable sources by 2020. This means in 10 years' time, the amount of electricity coming from sources like solar, wind and geothermal will be around the same as all of the electricity currently used by Australian households.
20% based on your estimate of what electricity production would be in 2020. So they're aiming to have 20% of their electricity produced by renewables in 2020.
While Labor did increase the renewable energy target, it was less consistent in terms of its policy settings for renewable energy.
It was a very tumultuous period for the industry during the Rudd and Gillard governments because there were frequent policy changes. Some of them weren't thought through very well. The Gillard government didn't do anything much more than the Howard government had done before it. In fact, they cut back on some of the programs that the Howard government had introduced, the rooftop program, for example, the credits that were applied, and that led to changes in the working environment for a lot of the companies and led to
people going out of business, but that's nothing compared with the concern at the present time about what would happen if the renewable energy target was scrapped.
The federal government's announced details of its review of the renewable energy target and specifically the impact it's having on power prices. The government argues that the market's changed since the target was set and there's now an oversupply of electricity.
We support sensible use of renewable energy. As you know, it was the former Howard government which initially gave us the RET. We've got to accept, though, that in the changed circumstances of today, the renewable energy target is causing pretty significant price pressure in the system.
We're all aware that there is an oversupply of electricity generation in Australia. We need to put that in that context as well. And the bottom line is we are looking at how we can reduce cost impacts both on industry and on households.
Green Senator Larissa Waters says it's clear what outcome the government is seeking through the review.
They've effectively put one of the biggest climate deniers in charge of reviewing clean energy.
With the renewable energy targets, we've actually been incredibly successful. Despite all the policy changes, we've been quite successful at getting or adopting renewable energy technology. And I'm just wondering, why would we want to scrap the targets then because they have been successful?
Yes, the target has been very successful, and for a couple of reasons. One is it's been one of the few longer-term policies that we've had. Industry's been able to plan on the basis of that target being in place, and it's been almost sacred up to now that no one's been prepared to touch it, and a lot of large wind farms and that sort of thing have been put in place. Other policies, like the rooftop solar program, has been bedeviled by frequent changes in policy, and a lot of the companies have gone out of business because the settings have changed so frequently. The reason why anyone would want to change it is that it's been too successful. It's been successful to the point that our renewable energy is now more than competitive with coal-fired generators without any subsidy, particularly the large wind farms. And the coal industry and the gas industry are very powerful, and they are very unhappy about the fact that renewable energy is taking such a large slice of the market. And I might add that's a declining market because people are also worried about electricity prices that have been installing energy efficient appliances, refrigerators, washers, dishwashers and so on, which use far less energy. So demand for electricity has been falling, and solar energy, solar and wind, have been taking up a much larger share. And so a lot of the coal and gas-fired producers and the miners have been quite concerned about the outlook for their business.
Professor Philip Jennings from Murdoch University. My other guests, Robin Batterham, former chief scientist for the Australian government, Professor Martin Green from the University of New South Wales, Gary Bavistock, former adjunct professor at Murdoch University, and Martin Thomas, founding MD of the Australian Cooperative Research Centre for Renewable Energy. Thanks to sound engineers Timothy Nicastri and Jenny Parsonage. And if you'd like to hear this program again or to read a transcript, head for the Rear Vision website, abc.net.au/rearvision. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.